Welcome to the Federalist Society Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Administrative Law and Regulation Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, April 8, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society Practice Group telephone conference call. Today, we're going to be discussing the use of science in setting policy. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we're very pleased to welcome our guest moderator, who will introduce our panel of experts. Susan Dudley is Director of Regulatory Studies at the Center at George Washington University. Prior to joining the GW faculty in 2009, she served as the presidentially appointed administrator of the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs in the U.S. Office of Management and Budget. She's a longstanding member of the Federalist Society's Executive Committee for the Administrative Law Practice Group, and we're very pleased to welcome her here as our moderator today. Susan Dudley, please go right ahead with your opening remarks and your introduction of our panels.
Thank you, Dean, and thanks for hosting this call. Public policies intended to address health and environmental risk depend heavily on scientific information, but these policies are often the subject of heated debate involving accusations of politicized science, advocacy science, and junk science. Recent reports from the Bipartisan Policy Center, the National Academy of Sciences, and the Keystone Group have offered recommendations for improving the use of science in public policy, and the Administrative Conference of the United States is currently developing recommendations for steps agencies could take to improve their procedures for incorporating science inputs in regulatory decisions. On the call today, we have some legal and policy experts to explore what they see as the most significant challenges facing how science is used to inform public policy and what can be done to overcome them. But before we hear from them, I'll take a few minutes to frame the discussion based on my observations as a policy official and academic interested in scientific information to develop effective regulatory policy. I think everyone can agree that it's important to protect the integrity of scientific findings, but more often than not, these contentious policy debates center on issues that science can inform but not decide. Science is rarely sufficient for making policy decisions for two reasons. First, while science is essential for understanding the positive question of what is, or predicting what outcomes might derive under different scenarios, it is less helpful for the normative policy decisions regarding what should be. Positive science can help assess risks, while normative factors like economics, ethics, law, etc., are needed to decide how to manage those risks. Second, even in the risk assessment phase of an analysis, scientists will never have complete information to predict outcomes with absolute certainty. So risk assessors rely on assumptions, judgments, and rules of thumb to guide the use of scientific information. Policymakers and the public are often unaware of the influence of these risk assessment policy choices or the existence of alternative choices that are equally plausible. Instead, assessments often generate precise-sounding predictions that hide not only considerable uncertainty about actual risk, but the reliance on biased inferences and assumptions for handling that uncertainty. Let me read you a short quote from an article by former EPA scientist Robert Lackey. Science should be objective and based on the best information available. Too often, however, scientific information presented to the public and decision makers is infused with hidden policy preferences. He calls this normative science and considers it, quote, a corruption of the practice of good science. Now, no one is immune from the temptation to put a spin on science to advance a policy goal, so it's useful to distinguish between two distinct types of problems that may contribute to the controversies we see. One is when political decision makers attempt to distort what scientific studies conclude. We'll call that the politicization of science. But another problem occurs when scientists and others attempt to exert influence on policy decisions by distorting or misrepresenting scientific findings. We'll call that scientization of policy. While media coverage of issues ranging from genetically modified organisms to climate change decries the first problem, the Bipartisan Policy Center's 2009 report on this topic emphasized the latter, observing, quote, a tendency to frame regulatory issues as debate solely about science, regardless of the actual subject in dispute, is at the root of the stalemate and acrimony all too present in the regulatory system today. So to talk with us a little bit more about the BPC report, its conclusions and recommendations, let me introduce our first panelist, from whom I borrowed that phrase, scientized policy. It's David Goldst. David is now Director of Government Affairs for the Natural Resources Defense Council, but he's speaking today wearing his hat as former director of the BPC's Improving the Use of Science in Regulatory Policy Project, a position he held from 2008 to 2009. David has more than 20 years of experience on Capitol Hill, working mainly on science and environmental policy, and he has served on several panels at the National Academy of Sciences. David?
Thanks very much, Susan. Appreciate the chance to be on today. So let me just say a word or two about the nature of the BPC report, and then I'll talk about the recommendations. I'll emphasize, as Susan just did, that I'm not in any way speaking in my NRDC role. So this was a report that was funded by the Hewlett Foundation, the Packard Foundation, and ExxonMobil. The funding was purposely designed to make sure that all political predilections and bases were covered. The panel was put together, the report was put together by a group of experts, many of whom have held federal policy posts, and ran the those people ran the gamut from John Graham, who was Susan's predecessor at the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs at OMB in the Bush administration, to Kevin Knobloch, the head of the Union of Concerned Scientists, and Union of Concerned Scientists was probably the group that was most vocal in raising concerns about the use of science in the Bush administration. The report was started to put it together early in 2008, so before there was any sense of who the candidates would even be in 2008, never mind who would win, and it came out in the summer of 2009. So the main idea of the report was, exactly as Susan said, to try to think about, were there ways, I guess the way I'd put it is, were there ways to make it clearer what arguments about science and regulatory, about science and regulation are about? So no one was under the illusion or even delusion that these debates were going to go away, but that it would be helpful if there were clearer guidelines on what people were actually fighting about, and that would actually maybe create a more honest and productive debate. And the first issue we dealt with was this issue that I've called scientization of politics, which is not necessarily distorting scientific findings, but basically, in effect, distorting the political questions that need to be answered by trying to frame them all as being, quote-unquote, objective scientific questions. And so the first set of recommendations that the Bipartisan Policy Center report made, and probably the ones that in some ways have, while there's discussion that's continued, have probably had the least effect in terms of actually being implemented so far, although they were also echoed by the, to some degree, by the Keystone Center report, is this notion of trying to separate out, to the extent possible, it can be murky, what's a science question and what's a policy question. And that even forcing people to go through that exercise would have positive effects, even if it required making fine distinctions. And so the first set of recommendations the Bipartisan Policy Center report made is that federal rulemaking should basically have requirements that would mandate that agencies lay out what they thought of as the policy questions and what they thought of as the science questions. And for this purpose, for science, we're talking about natural and physical sciences, what the policy questions and what the science questions were in any given regulatory matter. And then might also be asked as part of every rulemaking to answer questions like, what additional science would help resolve remaining questions, and when, how quickly would that science be likely to be available? Or agencies could be required to provide more than one policy option that they thought was consistent with the science. So this notion wasn't that the science required just policy X. And so that was the first set of recommendations in the report. And again, they're all premised on this notion that part of the problem is everyone wants to frame, sometimes it's not even conscious, but everyone wants to try to frame issues as scientific rather than as policy or political, because that seems to put your answer on a higher plane. And so the first effort was to try to make that harder to do. I'll just say, I'm probably going over, so I'll just say briefly, the other two sets of issues that the BPC report dealt with that I'm happy to go into after the other discussants speak are conflict of interest, which is another obviously battleground, especially conflict of interest in terms of advisory panels. While the report was not able to come to a consensus on what constitutes a conflict of interest, everyone agreed that A, that those definitions needed to be much clearer, they needed to be laid out a priori, and the more information on potential conflicts that members of panels had needed to be laid out for the public. And then the last area the report dealt with was in looking at the scientific literature reviews that either agencies or advisory panels undertook, that there needed there also to be much clearer criteria that were laid out in advance that made very transparent on what basis the agency or advisory panel was deciding which scientific studies should be reviewed, the criteria by which they would be reviewed, and the criteria by which they would be weighted, which are three separate pieces that often get conflated. So that was the main effort there. The report was used to some extent as the administration, Obama administration, has gone through and put in its new agency-by-agency scientific integrity policies, although those policies have been much more concerned with the straight politicization of science issues that Susan referenced than they have been with some of these matters. So with that, why don't I stop there? Let's hear what the other speakers have to say, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Okay, great. Thank you, David. Next, we'll hear from Alan Morrison. Alan is the Lerner Family Associate Dean for Public Interest and Public Service at GW Law School. For most of his career, he worked for the Public Citizen Litigation Group, which he co-founded with Ralph Nader in 1972 and directed for over 25 years. Alan is currently a senior fellow of the Administrative Conference of the United States, which is developing recommendations related to today's topic, and a member of the National Academy of Sciences Committee on Science, Technology, and Law. Alan?
Thanks very much, Susan. And I want to be clear, I am a non-scientist and don't purport to speak on behalf of the scientific community, but just as a lawyer who observes the interaction of science and administrative policy. I want to focus, as the administrative conference is focusing, on science in the rulemaking process. And it seems to me that in addition to the two areas that have been mentioned so far, that is scientific information and policy determinations, there are two other aspects of rulemaking that have to be kept in mind. One is that in many cases there are a number of facts that are objectively in the record that are really not science, or at least not science anymore because they've been established, that form a very important part of rulemaking. And second, of course, the law. The law tells rulemakers what is relevant, what are the standards by which science and other factors have to be taken into account. It ought to be that these four criteria are separate. Unfortunately, in the real world, they overlap, and the overlap is unclear in many areas. And so one of the recommendations that's being made is that regulators try as early on in the process as they can to identify the questions that fall into these different categories and to try to indicate what inquiries are directed toward questions of science and questions of policy. recognizing that it's never possible to keep them entirely separate. The second thing I want to mention is the administrative conference's recommendations are based on a very lengthy report by Professor Wendy Wagner from the University of Texas Law School. In the interest of full disclosure, I should tell you that Professor Wagner is a client of mine in an unrelated matter. I am bringing a constitutional challenge to a federal statute that deals with contributions by people who are government contractors, and since she is being paid by the administrative conference, she falls within that statute, which means that she can't make political contributions while she's under contract. In any event, Professor Wagner spent an enormous amount of time examining science at several different administrative agencies, and indeed examining it and how it's used at different subject areas and by different parts of the same agency, EPA, as well as work done by other parts of the government, the Interior Department and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And the thing that, to me, is the most interesting part of her paper is how differently science is handled by different agencies doing different kinds of determination in terms of where they start, the level of review that they undertake, the kind of questions that they ask, and the various techniques they use to get at good science and away from junk science. So one of the things that we all need to focus on is that science is not a one-size-fits-all for all agencies and for all determinations. And indeed, in each case, science may, by either statute or by the particular question being explored, have a greater or lesser importance. And so the notion of having science as simply being there and overriding everything and being able to be applied across the board is simply not realistic. And of course, scientists, unlike what lawyers think, actually are often very uncertain about the results of what they have found. They find associations without being able to prove causation. And so another thing that is very important to keep in mind is how certain are scientists, and hence how certain can regulators be, about the outcome of a particular scientific question. Finally, this is really actually the beginning, in each determination by an agency, the question is, where do you start? That is, do we go back to the very beginning of time, or what kind of assumptions are there to begin with? And what is an agency supposed to do when it's confronted with a scientific question? My understanding is that the best practice is to conduct a literature review and to decide which prior art is worth considering and which is not, and then, of course, to tell the public so the public knows what you've taken off the table to begin with. And then scientists have to proceed not just guessing what might be, but hunches based upon prior studies and a good idea of what they're going to be looking for, even if they don't know what they're going to be finding. And the other terribly important aspect at this time in the scientific process is to get these questions out as early as possible so that the public can understand where the science is starting from and where it's leading to at the end. I think I'll stop there and I can come back to talk about some of the specific recommendations that the administrative conference is considering regarding the uses and misuse of confidential business information, biases in financial disclosures, something called checkpoints, and then credits for authors and the right to publish and the right to dissent. Thanks very much, Susan.
Okay. Thank you, Alan.
Susan, Don. Sorry, before, I just want to point out, Professor Wagner was also part of the BPC study, so just so people are aware of that.
Okay, thank you, David. Our last presentation will be from E. Donald Elliott. Don teaches administrative and environmental law at Yale Law School and is senior counsel with Covington & Burling. He served as assistant administrator and general counsel of EPA and is a member of the National Academy of Sciences Board on Environmental Studies and Toxicology. He's also a senior fellow with the Administrative Conference of the United States and, like Alan and me, involved in its current project, developing recommendations for improving science in policy. Don, you've got your work cut out for you to stay within the time frame like the other two did.
All right, I'll try. Thank you very much, Susan. I found it a very interesting discussion so far. Of course, what we're talking about here is not really science, but what we're talking about is the use of scientific information by regulators, by agencies. And I agree quite strongly with Alan Morrison that one of the very interesting aspects of Wendy Wagner's report and also other studies is how much the use and the techniques for dealing with scientific information vary from agency to agency. Perhaps in the interest of disclosure, I should disclose that Wendy is a former student of mine at Yale Law School and a friend, and I certainly respect her work. But I think it's very difficult to talk about the use of scientific information across the entire administrative process because there are very substantial variations. I think that FDA, for example, does a pretty good job of getting the science right. I'm not sure that my old agency, EPA, always does, and I think it's very interesting to try to understand what agencies do this the best and what agencies have some problems getting the science correctly. I've also found it interesting that we're having this this discussion today without the presence of any scientists, at least as part of the panel. And I think in many ways this a lot of the things that we've been talking about, while important, really reflect the views of lawyers about how to improve the use of scientific information by agencies. They focus heavily on procedure and separating the scientific facts from the policy decisions, and all of that's important. They also focus very substantially, as do the recommendations by the administrative conference, on transparency and improving the ability of people to understand what the basis for decisions were. And as the as David Goldstone mentioned, an important issue that's received a lot of attention is the problem of conflicts of interest or failure to disclose financial interest in the outcome. And all of these are important problems, and I think important to be addressed. A couple of the things that we have not mentioned, let me just put them on the table. One of the great reforms in the use of science in the administrative process was made in the Clinton administration through the requirement in executive order that agencies have peer review programs. And I think that's been an extremely important development to try to improve the use of science to get conclusions reviewed by outside groups of independent scientists. So I think that's a positive thing. But peer review, like judicial review, is an attempt to correct mistakes after they happen or to identify things that are outside the range of reasonable interpretation. And so I spent some time, I'm actually not a scientist, but I am married to one. My wife, Gail Charnley, is a PhD toxicologist and former head of the toxicology program at the National Academy of Sciences. So the other day, I asked her and another scientist what they would recommend, and their approach to how to improve science and the use of scientific information by agencies was really remarkably different than what we focused on and what most lawyers have focused on. They talked about improving the quality and the expertise of the scientists inside agencies who are actually doing the assessment of scientific information, pointing out that many of these issues are issues of scientific judgment, and that many of the people in agencies are in positions that they are not properly trained or qualified for. I found that a very interesting perception. And it's interesting that when EPA itself, a few years ago, codified what it is required in order to do an all-appropriate inquiry, basically a property due diligence, one of the first things that they required is that the people doing them be qualified by training and experience to do what they're doing. And this is not necessarily always true at agencies. I could give some examples, but I probably won't. But I think the starting point to improve science is to make sure that the people at the agency who are going to be treated as experts by the courts really have the relevant expertise. And in some instances, the people that are doing toxicological risk assessments are trained in geology or physics and not really in the discipline that they're purporting to exercise. So I think that's an important addition. My last point has to do with the politicization of science, which the previous speakers, including Susan Dudley and David Goldstone, have talked about. And if I heard it correctly, and maybe I didn't, Susan talked about politicization as distortion of scientific information by, quote, political decision makers. And that certainly is a very real risk. But it's also the case that the career staff at agencies may also be guilty of distorting science. So I don't think we should focus the distortion of science solely at the political level, which I don't think was necessarily the intention. With that, I'll leave it for now and open it up to Susan.
Okay, thank you, Don. I'll just respond quickly to that, and then I'd like to ask all the panelists if they have other comments. On that one, I was trying to distinguish between two types of things that we see happen. One is the politicization of science, but I think another problem that often may be the more significant problem is what you're saying. It's people saying that science, misrepresenting scientific findings intentionally or unintentionally by hiding uncertainties, by using assumptions that hide a hidden policy preference. And that's what I've called scientization of policy. So I think both are important problems to watch out for, and I think we're less attuned to the scientization problem. David and Alan, do you have comments that you want to make before we open this up to questions from the audience?
No, I mean, I agree with
what the other speakers said, and I think Alan's point about law being the other element that obviously shapes the decision making is obviously critical, because it can affect what kinds of evidence, scientific and otherwise, are allowed to be taken into consideration. The ACUS report definitely, you know, draws on the Bipartisan Policy Center one, partly again because Wendy was such an active participant in both.
This is Alan. I do have a couple of supplements to Don's remarks, not so much disagreement. On the peer review, I think Don said it's like judicial review, it's fixing it after the fact. Well, that's not quite the way I would describe it. I would describe it as review before it becomes final, the idea being that somebody's got to make some findings first and recommendations first, and then they send them to peer review before they become finalized. And, of course, the other aspect of peer review is that they are costly, they take time, and they delay the final rule. And the question is always, is it worth it in a particular case? And especially if you're going to outside peer reviewers as opposed to others in the agency, that's another layer of complication on top of that. The administrative conference decided, I think quite sensibly, not to deal with peer review as part of the current recommendations, but they have, I think it's fair to say, and Don, Susan will probably back me up and support me on this, that there is some implicit promise that they will take it up at some time in the not-too-distant future. The second thing is I agree with Don that it's a great idea to have experienced and highly qualified people working at the agency. The problem, of course, is that some of the most highly qualified people would prefer to work in other environments, either where they have more freedom or more money or both. And so it's very desirable to have the most qualified people. I'm not sure under the current situation we're likely to get all of them, but we should surely be trying.
Yes, Susan, it's Don Elliott. Could I just pick up on that for a second?
Sure.
I agree with everything Alan has said, although with regard to peer review, as he knows, it really isn't one thing. There's a whole variety of different degrees of formality and costliness in terms of different ways to do peer review, from, you know, referring it to the National Academy of Sciences, to having a one-day conference with outside experts or the Science Advisory Board, or even, as he indicated, just others in the agency. So I think it's a term that covers a variety of different things in terms of just getting a second look at things. And he certainly is correct that it takes place after an initial assessment of the science, but before a final decision. I think with regard to his point about the difficulty of getting the top people in government to be making these decisions, I think he's certainly right that's always a problem. I think that one of the agencies that does really the best job on getting the science right, you can criticize it on a lot of other grounds, is the Food and Drug Administration, which has a very interesting process of having panels of outside experts. And it uses them in a different way than we typically have at EPA or other agencies, and that is it tasks them not only to make recommendations with regard to the science and to describe what the science is in terms of what we typically call risk assessment, but also to make recommendations which are subject to review by the political decision makers who aren't bound to follow them, but at least they ask the scientists, you know, what would you do and why? So they specifically empower them to make policy recommendations as well as simply the notion of just the facts. And I've sometimes thought, because I think that process works better than a lot of those that I've seen at EPA and elsewhere, I sometimes thought that the very understandable desire, going back to Bill Ruckelshaus, to separate science and policy has been maybe carried a little bit too far, because when you tell people, particularly highly motivated people serving in government or even outside government, that you're only interested in their factual opinions, you're not interested in their policy recommendations, I think it sometimes causes them to smuggle their policy views into their account of the science. And so I think we might actually be better off asking the scientists not only to give us the scientific facts, but also to make their policy recommendations, which are then subject to review by others.
So can I jump in on that one?
Sure.
I have thoughts on both of the things that Don just said. I mean,
so
first of all,
this is David speaking.
Yeah, sorry, this is David Goldston. There'd obviously be a range of opinion on how well FDA does things. I think it depends on the issue, but obviously FDA has a particular, almost unique relationship with the regulated entities, which are sort of connected at the hip, which is something to look at, the ways that helps and doesn't help the system. It's interesting that the point Don was making, I mean, in some ways the BPC report went in the opposite direction, which it said, there ought to be such a thing as scientific advisory committees where you are clearly only asking them about the science, and that you could have other advisory committees that have scientists on them that are also getting involved in the policy. But the problem comes when the charge to the committee, to the advisory committee, isn't clear. And that's when you get, it may not even be smuggling. It may be no one's even sure what the border was. And so you need to at least be clear on which kind of question you're asking. And I think the makeup of the committee is potentially different depending on what kind of question you're asking. So, but I think that is something to look at. On the peer review, I think there's two different aspects of peer review that are maybe getting combined. There's the peer review of each individual paper that's being looked at, which is obviously not something the agencies are doing, but something that's happening through the scientific process. And one of the things the BPC report called for is more experimentation by journals and others on seeing what kinds of peer review actually work best. You know, does double-blind peer review work best? Does everything being open work better? That we need, there's given how much we rely on peer review and view it as, you know, to paraphrase Churchill, the worst system except for all the others, we actually have very little empirical work on what kinds of peer review systems work best and for what things. Then there's the role of those peer reviewed papers in a regulatory process. And one thing that both the BPC and the Keystone process report said, with slightly different emphases, is that peer-reviewed papers should not be, you should be able to review things that are not peer-reviewed, but peer-reviewed papers, especially peer-reviewed papers from the top journals, should basically get, sort of a privileged spot in the literature reviews. Then there's the question of peer-reviewing the actual decision that an agency has proposed or made, really looking at the literature in bulk. And in that, as Don said, there's lots of different ways to do that with the academy, with something more informal like a conference. And there too, frankly, there's very little literature on, what works best, either in terms of the politics of it, what works best at resolving disputes, or at, which worked best in terms of getting the conclusion that later work seemed to confirm in terms of the scientific conclusion. So there's lots of different aspects of this, and each one raises questions that haven't been sufficiently explored, I think.
This is Alan. Can I just chime in on the FDA aspect for a second?
Yeah.
Two things about it. One is that the FDA advisory committees, which Don correctly identified, are typically called in for product-specific, be it drugs or medical devices, and whether they should meet the criteria, one of the criteria being safety, and, of course, safety is always a relative concept. So, we have that thing. Unlike in EPA, where most of what they do is through rules, in which the questions are rather different. And so it's not that we can't learn anything from FDA. It's just that the situations are sufficiently different that one ought to be cautious about saying, well, FDA does it this way and everybody else ought to do it the same way, because the nature of the questions being identified are quite different.
Let me just chime in on that before we open up to everybody. I think we have a real problem when we ask committees that are advisory groups that are purported to be scientific advisory groups for their policy positions, because it's not clear whether their advice, you can't tell whether their advice is their policy preference or a scientific or based on scientific information. The EPA's Clean Air Scientific Advisory Committee, when members were canvassed, they said that was one of the biggest problems that they faced, is it wasn't clear what they were supposed to be advising on. The distinction between their charge wasn't clear about whether it was policy versus science. So I think clearly delineating the science and the policy is important. And I'd say maybe the Safe Drinking Water Act would be a good way of looking at how that works better, where it's pretty clear that the science will give you some information on what the risks might be, but then the agency is allowed to make policy decisions taking into account other factors.
Well, let's move to questions, but I think this is Don Elliott again. I think one of the things we're all in agreement on is that there are a lot of different contexts, and it's very important to get the charge clear.
Dean, if you could open up to questions, we're ready to address them.
Thank you very much. After in a moment, everyone should hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question for any of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So please hold on. So once again, if you have a question for any of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on our telephone. At this point, we have one caller question, and then our lines will be open. So again, if you'd like to join the conversation, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our first caller.
Hi. Hi, this is Dan Epstein. I'm at an organization called Cause of Action that does kind of government accountability work, and I wanted to know what any of the panelists thought about the Data Quality Act. This is something that it appears there's a split in the circuits as to whether this provides a right to judicial review. And I was curious from my organization's standpoint whether any of the panelists thought that the Data Quality Act or Information Quality Act was kind of a good tool or a bad tool for getting agencies to correct the scientific record and increase scientific integrity.
This is Alan. You've asked two questions. Is there a cause of action, or should the courts be involved in it at all? And the answer is, I think the answer is yes. I've been unfortunately on the wrong end of some litigation, which the courts have refused to get involved in it. So I'm on the record on that question. Second, as to whether it's a good idea or a bad idea, I don't know the answer to that question. I think it has the potential for some mischief, but so far it hasn't proven to be very mischievous. So I guess on balance, I would say it's probably okay. If it turned out that both judicial review over some extreme refusals to correct turned into judicial review over every time an agency offered a scientific or other opinion on anything, I would be very troubled by it. But I don't think it's going to end up that way. And fortunately, the OMB regs were not as open-ended and as welcoming of constant requests for reviews as some feared they might be.
This is Don Elliott. I would be in substantial agreement with Alan. I think in general, I think it's a good tool, but I don't think it should be carried to extremes. I think it's a question of as with judicial review generally or with peer review of applying it to major important decisions where things are relatively clear. And what we don't want to do is get the court involved or courts involved or process involved on relatively small and unimportant issues, because the transaction costs would not be worth the benefit.
This is Susan, and you've heard from both of the lawyers. I'll just tell you, the Administrative Conference of the United States, the draft recommendations, which are available on ACUS.gov, do reference the information quality guidelines and say that agencies talk about them making sure that agencies make or ensure that members of the public can reproduce and verify the agency's analytical results consistent with the guidelines and the Act. David, did you have something?
Yeah, although not much. I was going to associate myself with Alan's comments about the potential for mischief in terms of, and Don also in terms of the concerns about the potential for excessive judicial involvement. I'd also say that the dispute that sort of led to the Data Quality Act being passed turned out in a way that I think the concerns about the data that was at issue there proved to be unfounded. So for whatever lesson people want to take from that, but it, you know, grew out of a particular dispute where I think there were allegations that turned out not to have a lot of merit.
But even in that, this is Don Elliott again, even if it turns out that people's charges about agency information are incorrect, having a process in which that can be examined and ventilated can be helpful.
True.
In terms of creating credibility. And so I think if it's applied judiciously, it can be helpful. But we've had an unfortunate tendency sometimes in the past for courts to go too far, and particularly in scientific issues. My old mentor, Judge Bazelon on the D.C. Circuit, always used to quote Socrates in terms of wisdom being not knowing what you don't know. And it's always hard for judges when they're examining science and they really haven't been trained in the field to be sufficiently deferential. So it is potentially a problem, but I think overall it's a positive factor.
And the other thing that the Bipartisan Policy Center weighed in on it was that to the extent you were going to use the Data Quality Act or Information Quality Act, it should be equally applicable to all data involved in a federal decision. And so there have been issues about data that comes from private sources that's privately funded sources that's part of the decision, not being as available for scrutiny as publicly funded research, and so that's another concern.
Okay, Dean, do we have other questions?
Let's hold on right now. We don't have any questions pending at this time. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone to ask a question of our expert. Perhaps I can take this opportunity to make a brief commercial announcement. We have three more telephone conference calls scheduled for the remainder of the week. Tomorrow, Tuesday, April 9th at 2 p.m., we'll be discussing the public ownership of law firms. Thursday, also at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, we'll be discussing the state of the patent system with Judge Rader of the Federal Circuit and law school professor Adam Mossoff. And then Friday at 12 noon Eastern Time, we'll be talking about the role of the Pentagon and the National Security Administration in policing domestic cyber terror threats. With that, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. And right now, Susan, we don't have any questions pending.
Well, let me ask maybe a general question for the panelists. Given the distinction that we've made between politicized science and scientized policy, of the things that we've discussed, Don was concerned that we're focusing too much on procedure and transparency and not enough on getting the right people. How do you think, and maybe this is particularly for Don, how would that address the problem of the fact that we have policy preferences, everyone does. So I think that's the focus of the transparency and procedural issues, is to try to make clear when one is speaking from their policy preference and when they're presenting facts.
Well, my experience, going back to my time as general counsel at EPA, is that it's very difficult for people to ignore their policy preferences. It's very hard to leave your policy preferences at the door, particularly in government, because I think, as Alan alluded to, people in government may not be making as much money as they might in some other context, and therefore people often get the psychic satisfaction of being involved in important decisions. So I think we're all in agreement that we want to separate people's scientific understanding, scientific information about the facts from their policy preferences. I think the question is, what's the best way to do that? And is it the best way to do that to tell people, just check your policy preferences at the door and put them out of your mind and don't let them influence your views? I think that's impractical. So I think it's better to get people on record and require them to separate their policy advice from their legal advice or their scientific advice. And I think that what that does, Susan, is you mentioned CASAC and the unclear charge. I think it's better to have a group like CASAC or an FDA advisory committee specifically separate its policy views from its factual views of the science. And I think that empowers people on the committee to say to others, well, now, is that a policy recommendation or is that a scientific one? Because I think this is something that Wendy Wagner identified many years ago in a very famous article in the Columbia Law Review called the toxic risk charade, where agencies will sometimes make a decision on political grounds and then try to justify it on scientific grounds. So I think we're all in agreement that they shouldn't be muddled together. The question is, what's the best way to separate them?
John, yeah, this is David. Oh, go ahead, Alan.
No, go ahead. You go ahead, Dave.
So I agree with that. And actually, the CASAC case, the Clean Air Science Advisory Committee, is an interesting one. I mean, for other reasons, I was rereading some of the CASAC papers on the 1997 Clean Air Act regulations. And actually, in that one, they were very clear. I mean, first there was, you know, they have to review the document that gathers the scientific papers and say these are the right scientific papers and they were reviewed in the right way. They did that. Then they have to respond to the staff recommendation on what EPA's regulatory proposal should be, and they basically asked themselves two distinct questions. One, was the staff recommendation consistent with the science? And then they asked a separate question, which ended up getting them in the middle of a lot of disputes, but at least was very clearly separate, which was, as individuals, given all the policy factors, which in that case don't include cost, but including all the policy factors, where would they, as individual scientists, set the standard? And they were very clear in that case that they thought it actually was that EPA had given a reasonable range, that it was a totally a policy call, not a scientific decision on what the exact number should be. And then they, as individuals, each said what their personal recommendation would be, which included the recommendation that I'm not going to give one, it's up to EPA. And so in that case, they did, I think, exactly what Don is talking about. That was partly because of the nature of that debate and the people on it. I think, you know, there needs to be something systematic making clear what question they're being asked. And again, whether you impanel the exact same people to answer both kinds of questions, because you may not want to do that.
Yeah, if I could just have a little footnote on that, I would contrast that process, which I agree with David, works relatively well, with a process that happens more typically at EPA, in which the decisions are made in the first instance by political leadership, and then the science is written up as a form of rhetorical justification rather than really being an input to the decision. So,
Alan, go on.
Okay, thanks, Susan. So just taking the Clean Air Act and the language quoted in Whitman against the American Trucking Association,
right.
The statute says make levels that are requisite to protect public health with an adequate margin of safety.
Right.
Are those science questions? Are they policy? And how can anyone separate them out?
Yeah, I think
FDA,
you're right. Yeah.
At the FDA, you're told to have a drug can be permitted to be on the market if it's safe and effective. We know that anything that's effective is unlikely to be absolutely safe, and so we're talking about comparisons there, and the same with effectiveness. And ideally we would separate them out, but at least if we can't separate out the conclusions, we can at least separate out and try to put forth the facts on which we base the conclusions and recognize that words like adequate and requisite to protect the public health are not self-defining. They are clearly policy in some respects, and
right.
to recognize that fact, at least we wouldn't be kidding ourselves or trying to kid other people.
Well, that's right.
I don't think anybody would
that statutory language. Just a minute, Don. Give me a moment. I think that statutory language clearly does call for normative judgments, and it talks about in the judgment of the administrator.
Right.
And yet, it has because. The courts have ruled that you really can't make some of the trade-offs that normally one would make in making a normative judgment. It almost demands that people hide their policy judgments behind what's supposed to be science. And I will put forth that I think that's why the NAAQS standards are the most contentious of all the standards that are set. I can't think of another set of standards that the last three presidents have had to override his agency's decision on ambient air quality standards, and we don't see that with other things.
Well, I think on ambient air quality, I mean, there's a couple of things. I mean, I don't know if we're losing our audience already. I'm sure Don has some thoughts on this, which at least I'd be interested to hear. But, one reason the ambient air quality standards are so contentious is because the impacts are widespread and they cost a lot and they're imposed on counties. So aside from the other things, and the ones that have been overridden are ozone, because the cost benefit is the closest on that, not so much on the others. But leaving aside the cost question, which is obviously what you're referring to, there are other questions which, as Alan says, I mean, require judgment and policy judgment, but have a genuine scientific basis as opposed to just, you know, being a way to talk about costs without saying it. And those were dealt with quite explicitly in some of these air pollution questions. So an adequate margin of safety has been taken to mean to raise a question about what subgroups of the population that are particularly vulnerable do you have to protect, to what extent and to what circumstance, and to what extent, and in what circumstances. And so that question on getting some data on what the impact on them is at least partially a scientific question. The question of how to pick those is a mixed science and policy, and then the question of what level of protection for them is enough to satisfy the law is almost entirely a policy question. But there's a range there of questions that are legitimately in the science, at least touch on the scientific arena, that are separate from the question of can you have the discussion without getting into cost.
Susan, this is Dean Reuter breaking in. I wanted to let you know we've got about 5 minutes left, and it looks like we've got two caller questions pending now. Should we take another question?
Yes. Yeah, let's do that.
Here we go.
Yeah, sure. David Emerson in Berkeley. You know, going beyond the unintentional distortion inherent with an individual or unconscious bias of scientists, and going to a level beyond that, which is sort of the level of misconduct, where there's an intentional manipulation of data or results, or actually even working in concert with other scientists to create a conspiracy, to create a consensus where none really ought to exist. What are the thoughts of the participants on whether the scientific community can be self-policing or whether there should be consequences to the individual scientists or their institutions who participate in that level of misconduct?
So this is David. I'll start with maybe a general answer. That question is the one that the agency-by-agency scientific integrity guidelines are designed to deal with. They're designed to get something done. It said earlier, not only a political appointee doing something to the science, but the staff scientist somehow choosing for whatever reason to misrepresent or misconduct the science. So NIH has dealt with this for a long time in areas that aren't regulatory, but just in terms of scientific misconduct, which is can happen. And I'm not really sure about the distinction you're asking. I mean, in some ways, the community has to be self-policing in that they're the ones most likely to initially turn up the problem. But if the question is, should then the penalty be left exclusively to the scientific community, especially when it's part of a political process and decision-making? No. I mean, I think there should be consequences beyond that.
Yeah, this is Don Elliott. I'd like to pick up on that. I don't think it rises to the level of misconduct exactly, but I think the real issue in many agencies today is the so-called weight of evidence evaluations. So you have a lot of different studies, and the agency chooses to go with some of them and to discount others. And one of the things that the ACUS recommendations do that I think is quite positive is try to urge agencies, as the National Academy of Sciences has, to try to be more transparent about why they choose to believe some studies and not others, and to try to commit themselves to a little bit more regular process for deciding what how much weight they give to certain studies as opposed to other studies. I think there is a perception or a belief, at least in the regulated community, that often agencies simply discount the studies that don't reach the conclusions that they want and give undue weight to other studies which may support their result. And I think that whether that's true or not, the credibility of agency assessments of science will be improved if they are a little bit more transparent and regular about what they mean by the weight of evidence.
Yeah, and that was part of both the BPC and the Keystone studies to do exactly that, as well as the ACUS report.
Dean, do you think we have time?
I was just going to say we have one more question. If the caller's quick, maybe we can just get this final question in.
That would be great.
Thank you. I'll be quick. You just mentioned about the weight of evidence evaluation. My question is, how does the fact that much of the scientific research done today, its funding, is not independent of government, how does that affect the policy outcomes, i.e., if government were not channeling dollars for some research and not for other research, how would that change the long-term landscape and the policy outcomes you're discussing?
Well, David, I mean, this won't be the answer you want necessarily, but, you know, there, one couldn't argue that there's never any effect, but, you know, there, I haven't ever seen any specific evidence that that's the main thing going on. And in some of these issues, the agency doing the regulatory process is not necessarily the agency that has funded much of the work that it's being drawn on. And some of the major funders, NIH, NSF, DOD, don't do any regulatory work. So, you know, it's something that actually needs to be looked at. It's become more and more of a political issue, whether the funding affects the federal funding affects the outcome. But I don't know that there's any record indicating that that's a big part of the problem right now.
This is Susan. In my experience, I think that is a problem, and maybe in part the outcome of a particular study, but also what kinds of studies get funded. David made a good point early on that one of the important things about distinguishing science and policy and explaining uncertainty is to figure out what additional science we need to help resolve and reduce those uncertainties. And right. In my experience, I think we're lacking there, and that may it may have something to do with that.
Yeah, this is Don Elliott again. I want to agree with Susan and maybe disagree a little bit with David. I do think there are some problems here. It's very well understood in science generally that there is something called publication bias, which is basically you publish studies that find an association. You don't necessarily publish studies that are don't find an association. And I think something like that takes place at least in the environmental area, and that is researchers are much more likely to get their research funded if it finds a problem in areas where there is current agency interest. So I do think that this is a potential issue, and that the issue of funding should not just be directed at private regulated entities, but we should also think about the way in which the government does it. And there are some models. I won't go into them, but NIH and others have some pretty good models of deciding what to fund.
And there's also, one last slide, this, David, that does pick up on Don's point, the idea of which FDA has started of, it doesn't work for every field, but a registry so that people know studies are happening regardless of whether they come up with a positive or negative outcome is something that would be a step forward in areas where it's applicable, and that's also something that the BPC study endorsed.
Susan, any final thoughts before we adjourn?
No, I really thank the panelists. I thought it was an interesting discussion, and I thank you, Dean.
Well, thank
yes,
you.
Thanks, Dean. And to be continued.
Yes.
Yes.
this seems like an ongoing discussion, but on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank Susan Dudley, our moderator, for organizing the call, Alan Morrison, David Goldston, and Donald Elliott for participating. We certainly appreciate your thoughts and sharing them with us today. I want to thank the audience as well for its participation and questions, and invite you all to join us tomorrow at 2 p.m. for our next Teleforum conference call, when we'll be looking at the public ownership of law firms. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.